Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Center of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Mike Wangpa. Today, we're going to be exploring the political situation or political future of the Republic of Chad. My guest today is Dr. Nathaniel Powell. Nathaniel is the Africa analyst at Oxford Analytica. Nathaniel, You've been in the news recently. You've been in the news lately for your views on these situations in the Sahel and also other former French African colonies. I'm glad to have you join me today, and I look forward to a very fruitful conversation.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. So Chad is set to go to the polls. I think 6th of May, if I'm not wrong. But there's been so much political crisis in that country since the long-term military ruler Idriss Déby died and the son ceasefire was imposed. Help me make sense of how these events have unfolded and what impact they've had or we have on the political future, political drive towards democracy in that country.
Sure. So I guess you could say that the current round of crises, in the plural, started in April 2021. And that's when then President Idriss Déby was killed in battle, which is very rare for political leaders these days. He was killed in battle against a rebel group coming from Libya, or based in Libya. It was a Chadian rebel group, but they were based in Libya, and they had made it much of the way towards the capital, Jamina, and that's where they engaged the Chadian army. And Déby was the head of his troops and was killed in the fighting. Even though the rebels eventually were defeated and they were forced back into Libya, the president was gone. So within, I think there's some lack of clarity about whether he was killed on April 19th or 20th. But on April 20th, 2021, the government announced that he had died and that he had been replaced by his son. One of his sons, he had several sons, Mohamed Idriss Déby, who at the time was the head of the Presidential Guard, which is the main, it's not just a small unit, it's basically a large chunk of the military, it falls under this designation, and it's kind of the elite section of the military, the really functional part of the Chadian military, and his son was the commander, and he was anointed, elected, chosen by a group of other military leaders, kind of junta to take over the transition as new elections were going to be organized and a new constitution promulgated and that sort of thing. The thing is, this violated the constitution. So the constitution, according to the Chadian constitution, if the president dies or the presidency becomes vacant, the president of the National Assembly is supposed to take power. He very conveniently said, "Oh, I'm not going to do it for health reasons. So sorry, I'm not doing this." I mean, like the general consensus is that he was told that he was not going to take power, and that was that. So this has been described as a coup because it was an unconstitutional seizure of power by an unelected military officer. At the same time, this is, I think, domestically and within the military and security apparatus, within the state and factions close to the Déby family, this is seen as regime continuity. This is a, if you call it a coup, it's a coup to ensure that the regime remained the same, you know. Now, not everything remained the same. I mean, some parts of the ruling families that were close to the former First Lady, Hinda Debbie, were pushed out of power and new people were brought in. But the Debbie dynasty, if you want to call it that, still, you know, still holds power in the country. Now, the transition since then, so that was April 2021, right? So it's been almost 3 years. And initially, when Debbie took power, he said that he was planning this transition would last 18 months and it'd be elections. Which would be October 2022, and those didn't happen. In the meantime, there was an effort to reach a peace agreement with as many armed groups as possible, except for the FACT, which was the main rebel group that had invaded in 2021. And most rebel groups actually agreed to this agreement. Now, there were something 40 or 43 different armed groups, many of whom were more like generals without armies, more, you know, rather than actually, you know, significant armed factions, but some were. And they were brought on board, co-opted, you know, in exchange for political amnesties, restitution of property, government positions, integration in the army, that sort of thing, your standard sort of deal that you make with a rebel group. These have been brought on side onto the political transition. And then after this was done, there was what they call a national dialogue process, which has become very common in a number of countries in the region, where they bring in lots of civil society organizations, political parties, that sort of thing, with the idea of legitimizing the transition, but also creating new constitutional and political arrangements for elections to happen. And the bulk of the opposition actually boycotted this dialogue. So, you know, this actual legitimacy is contested, although Chad's international partners were happy to accept it, including the United States and France, France above all, of course. Now, right after this national dialogue ended in October 2022, there's big demonstrations in the capital, especially in Jamana, but also in some of the southern cities like Sar. And there were these protests were massively repressed. There's a lot of uncertainty about the number of deaths, but anywhere between 50 and 300 is reasonable. Over 1,000 people were arrested, some brutally tortured, some underage. A lot of them were underage, you know, like under the age of 18. And sent to this, you know, very kind of harsh desert prison in Korotoro, which is in northern Chad. And eventually they were amnestied and released, but only after about a year, 8 months or so. And, you know, there were some deaths in prison as well, and, you know, lots of human rights condemnations about not only the repression of the protests, but also the handling of the mass arrest and the treatment of prisoners. So this was a reaction to the decision made during a national dialogue to extend the transition by 2 more years and also allow Debbie to run for president, where he initially said, oh, I'm just going to be the caretaker and then we're going to have elections and have a, you know, civilian president. So Debbie is, as of now, an official candidate for the May elections. The elections were originally scheduled for December and they brought them forward. I think it's probably a number of reasons for that. But at present, it seems pretty clear that there's no chance that he loses the election. It's been arranged like every previous Chadian election. There's never been a free and fair election in Chad that he will win. The kind of novelty of this election is that his prime minister will be running against him. His prime minister was, until last November, the most prominent opposition figure. His name was Sukse Mazla. And he's very vocal, you know, very vocal and ardent and well-respected critic of the regime until November, when he signed an agreement bringing him back to Chad. He was in exile after the protests in October 22. November 2023, he comes back to Chad, essentially agreeing not to criticize the regime too much anymore. And then a couple months later, in January, he was named prime minister. And this followed a constitutional referendum, which passed without surprise, overwhelmingly. Which didn't make too many changes to the current constitution, but set the stage for the elections that were upcoming. And so now he's the prime minister, and that essentially, from the view of most of the opposition and outside observers, kind of caps a long process of co-optation of major opposition figures, of armed group leaders, and, you know, and creating a basically setting the political grounds for ensuring that he can, maintain the president, stay in power, and then, you know, become elected, stay in power as long as possible, and consolidate his authority over the country. There are open questions about how long he can keep all of these people on side. A lot of it depends on his resources, on, you know, what kind of prospects they see for the future. I think also popular mobilization will play a role in terms of whether some of these figures see it in their interest to continue sticking with the regime or not. But at the moment, there seem to be few formal obstacles to Deby remaining in power. Now, the big question that's been raised is his the fragility of his within his regime. We could talk about that if you want, and the regional situation that may make his rule actually a lot more fragile than it seems on the outside. But yeah, that's where we are right now.
Yeah, that's good. I'll come to part of the fragility that you've mentioned now, and then the regional implication. It ties into what I was going to talk about. So we've seen in that region, in the Sahel region, we've seen like this wave that have, you know, swept this anti-French sentiment wave that has swept the Sahel region, mostly former French colonies. You know, we've seen these military takeovers, unlike in Chad, where the kind of military takeover, like you said, was kind of like different from what's happened, like what we've seen in Niger, then in Mali, and Burkina Faso, Gabon, and all these other places. And then we've seen French withdrawing from these places or being asked to leave these places by this contact government. But it seems to be the opposite in Chad. There seems to be some form of I won't say endorsement, but some kind of like closeness between General Mahama and Deby with the French president. How is this? Why is it so? Or is it only a matter of time before that wind of change, you know, comes to Chad?
Well, it's an excellent question. So I would think it's hard to tell because, you know, there are no mass surveys of the population and popular opinion and that sort of thing to base anything on. But I think it's clear from the rhetoric of opposition leaders and even people within, you know, armed groups that and even people close to the presidency that there is a lot of resentment towards France. So this popular, what is often described as anti-French sentiment, which is really a kind of anger at French policies, is pretty widespread. And within Chad as well, there's you know, certainly some degree of popular resentment and anger towards France for its longstanding support of, you know, of dictatorships in the country. Now, Deby sort of played on this a little bit. And in January, he went to visit Russia, you know, big state visit, welcomed by Vladimir Putin, you know, looks like a big poke in the face of France. And this is at a moment where France is talking about changing the character of its entire military presence, not just in the Sahel, but across the continent. And indeed, they are withdrawing substantial numbers of troops from Gabon, from Cote d'Ivoire, and from Senegal. And they were talking about removing troops from Chad. Now, after this visit to Russia, in which no real major announcements were made, you know, about, you know, Chadian and Russian, you know, friendship and, you know, some development aid and you know, possible discussion about security issues, there were no announcements, you know, that seemed to be significant. But within a couple of weeks of Deby coming back to Chad, Jean-Marie Bockel, who is the new French government designated emissary to different African governments on this security troop withdrawal issue, visited Chad, announced that actually French troops would not withdraw from Chad, as was previously being discussed. And that he and President Macron were full of admiration for Deby in the political transition. And this happened just 5 days after the main remaining opposition leader was assassinated in cold blood in front of his political party headquarters, which sends a very strong message. The French really don't care about the, you know, about the way the country's governed, as long as they get to keep a foothold there. And, you know, quite apart from that, Deby's really been trying to diversify his security partnerships, at least on paper. So, I mean, he's reached out a lot to the United Arab Emirates. He just visited the country recently, although apparently did not get very much. But he has received lots of money and equipment from them, partly in exchange for his support to the RSF in Sudan. But also the Hungarian army sent a deployment to Chad, several hundred troops. It's unclear why they've done that. I think it's more for domestic Hungarian political reasons, but you know, it is a way for the Chadians to signal to the French and others that, you know, they have other options than the French. And, you know, and in the visit to Russia is also telling the French, oh, we have other options than you if you want to leave and drop us, you know. Mm-hmm. So and partly that is maybe in response to rumors that Macron was not very happy with Deby's transition process, and that you know, there were noises in the French government that the French troops were going to downgrade their presence or perhaps even leave the country entirely. And that kind of, this is not the first time this happened in Chad, where the French start making noises and the Chadian leader also makes noises, and that compels the French to stay. That seems to have been what happened. Now, what the French provide for him from the interest of the regime is that they essentially provide protection against a rebel overthrow. After the death of Idriss Déby's father in April 2021, Macron made a statement saying that France will never let this happen again. And they had actually intervened several times in the past to prevent a rebel overthrow of Déby's father. The reason they didn't this time seems to be that they weren't asked to actually intervene at that point. And Déby had hoped that he could. They did provide intelligence assistance and reconnaissance of the rebel movements, but they didn't actually intervene militarily. But this time, I think the general feeling is that if something like that were to happen again, the French would intervene in military, either with airstrikes or something else. And that is an important kind of in a country where recurring cycles of rebellion are a historical feature since the 1960s, you know, having that kind of security guarantee, or at least a partial security guarantee, is definitely beneficial for the regime. And, you know, with that, of course, comes, security assistance, training, that sort of thing, money, which also benefits, certain parts of the government as well. But again, this comes with, if there ever was a change in government in Chad, and if Déby was overthrown, in a coup d'etat or something else, one easy way to gain popular legitimacy in a short term would be to throw out the French and to denounce the French presence and to break relations with Paris. And that is, it's a very possible thing. Déby probably himself won't do it, but a replacement, if he's replaced in an unconstitutional manner, and it's unlikely he can be replaced in a constitutional manner, you might have this something like happen in Niger. It's possible.
So many things come up from what you said at that time, but there's one in that let me ask this: the African leverage, because we've seen in the Cold War, during the bipolar war, where African military authoritarian government were able to leverage the competition between the Soviet Union and use that to advantage. So I've interviewed some people, I've brought some people into the panel, and usually what I've seen, the trend I've seen is those that are in the West, some of my guests that are from the West, so let me put it this way. Some people that I've interviewed from Africa or kind of like see this anti-French wave as credible. I think you share a bit of that sentiment when I've seen somewhere you were quoted about, I think it's common knowledge anyways, French policy, security policies in these regions, depending on this corrupt and authoritarian legitimate regime. Mm-hmm. So that is not even debatable. But however, what most experts equally condemn in the West, my Western guest, is like the closeness with emerging powers like Russia. Mm-hmm. And you've also mentioned there are other middle powers as well. Like you just mentioned Hungary, and I didn't know about Hungary, but yeah, middle powers as well. So their argument is they don't see Russia as having as no bigger threat than what French already possesses. And now what you've seen from, you've given me a bit of an insight at the African government, or maybe using it as a leverage to keep maybe the French policy in check or whatever. Can you expand on that? Is there more reason why?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I have to say right up front that there's, the Chadian regime is very opaque, right? It's hard to really know what their political calculus is. It's hard to really know. And, it's not just their calculus vis-a-vis France and the Emirates or regional powers. It's also internal regime politics that are really hard, hard to decipher. We're playing criminology when we're talking about the Chadian government, what's happening inside, lots of rumors. It's really, we know that there's lots of dissensions within the Zagawa political leadership, and they're the ethnic kind of one of the main ethnic constituencies of the government, for instance. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to suss out what exactly that entails and what the balance of political power is within that kind of framework. But when it comes to France, and this kind of playing off of powers. Yeah, I mean, because the Chinese have done this for a long time. You know, through the Cold War, they play the Libyans off against the French. They play the Americans off against the French, and to a lesser extent, the Soviets off against the French. And it was very effective. The problem is from the outside perspective, it looks and it is true that there's a massive imbalance of power, right? The French have far more power than the Chadian government does. But what that means from the perspective of whatever Chadian regime is in power is that, you know, they actually do have leverage over the French in the sense that the French would prefer that regime, you know, however, unsavory they might seem, however, you know, whatever their government strategies may look like, you know, better them than the alternative. And for the French, that's always seen, they've always seen the alternative as either the Russians jump in and replace them, or you have a civil war, or you have jihadists appearing because there's a destabilization in the country. You know, Chad is seen by France as a pillar of regional stability because, you know, apart from, you know, conflicts as peripheries like in the Lake Chad region, you know, it's not affected by jihadists, you know, insurgencies. It's not affected by, you know, major conflicts. I mean, it's only partly true, but, you know, compared to Mali and compared to, you know, the Lake Chad Basin and compared to, you know, Burkina Faso, you know, it looks pretty good. And for the French perspective, you know, the reason for that is because of the, you know, governance of Idriss Déby and then his son. So they want to invest in that and protect it because the alternatives are worse. Which gives whoever's in power in N'Djamena a lot of leverage over the French. And I think we've seen that, you know, with the trip to Russia. But the rise in what is described as anti-French sentiment, I think that term needs to be problematized a bit, does offer another degree of leverage for the Déby regime, because he can say, look, my population doesn't really like you very much. And it wouldn't be too hard for me to, you know, drop you and gain popular legitimacy that way, you know, and maybe go to somebody else like the Russians, you know. So you better offer me something that's worth keeping you, you know, worth me allowing you to stay here. And in the current context, you know, if this happened in the 60s or 70s, and they did this to some extent in the 60s and 70s, you know, there was always the risk the French could overthrow them, right? That's more difficult today. I think that the French would have a difficult time doing that, not just for political reasons, but also because of their actual leverage over the kind of levers they would need to effectuate that kind of a change in government. So that changes a little bit the balance of power between N'Djamena and Paris in terms of, you know, Paris really wants to stay there. And, you know, it's almost seen as more important in Paris that they stay there than it is in N'Djamena that they stay there, which gives whoever's in power there, you know, significant, or at least allows them to bluff it. To bluff the potential going to Russia. You know, it is a political game. It is about manipulation. It's about trying to see who, you know, what you can get the best out of, you know, whichever partner you possibly can. But, you know, sometimes those games can backfire too. You know, it's you know, if the French go and nobody replaces them, then he might have just lost significant element of regime protection. And I'm sure he realizes that too. So,
Go ahead. Yeah, I think what you're saying is what someone has said about what's going on in Niger with the US being asked, the military agreement being terminated in Niger, and how that could backfire in terms of the military might not be able to provide the security that's needed. But I was going to ask, you know, well, not that there's a lot of political gaming going on here, but I believe in the post-Cold War, or in the last, since 2000, anyway, since 9/11, there's been, from the Western side of things, there's been much focus on stabilization.
Yeah.
On just, you know, as long as, you know, let's not disrupt the system. And that has led to the toning down of maybe true democracy, or where, you know, we could look the other way if it's going to cost a little bit of stuff. So, which to me is the over focus on stabilization from the West is counterintuitive. But I think I wanted to comment on that, because looking at bringing it back to the elections now, and look at what transpired since then. So again, I can see some elements of the pre of the 90s or 80s military. If I bring Nigeria, for instance, the last two military rulers, Babangida and all of that, they manipulated the transition process, keep postponing it. You know, finally, they wanted to become a president and legitimize. I could see that happening, yeah. And there was a lot of assassination of...
It's almost the rule rather than the exception, right?
Yeah, it's more that rule rather than exception. So I'm looking at how does one balance? Because the West, again, one cannot but be sympathetic towards the West as well. And look at how do you balance... How can you ensure democratic values... How can you do it? Are they pursuing stabilization at the expense of true democracy, or are they just in a place where in a dilemma where they, you know, they can't really do much?
I mean, what I always say about Western policy is that it's a lot easier for them to do harm than good. You know, even if they mean to do good, even if the intentions are good, and the intentions aren't always good, right? Or the intentions are always, you know, often more ambiguous. But even if the intentions are good, you know, we're talking about, you know, like democracy and true accountability and, you know, real responsive and inclusive governance is something that has to emerge from wherever it exists. You can't bring that in from the outside. And, you know, it's really, if you look at the language that, you know, is used to rationalize and is used in all sorts of different, you know, programs coming from, you know, the U.S., France, Germany, the U.K. to, you know, to focus on governance and institution building and, you know, human rights education and that sort of thing. You know, some of those are fine. But my feeling is, you know, you're talking about, we're using the word governance and we're using all these terms like institutions and capacity building, which are all very kind of technical language to describe what is a very deeply political question and a very deeply political intervention. And, you know, if you want democracy in a country, you know, first of all, as an outsider, there's not much you can do. You can reinforce into autocracy really easily, but it's really hard to bring about a democracy or facilitate a democratic transition from the outside. But you know, what I mean, if you want to improve governance, that means essentially changing the balance of power in a country. Because governance, at the end of the day, is who has power over whom. And you know, as an outsider, if you start messing with that, you know, then you're likely to make things worse. And, you know, you can do lots of kind of cosmetic, like, yeah, sure, like have some workshops about human rights. That's great. Like, I'm all for it. And, you know, also that does provide some potential leverage for example, civil society groups or non-governmental organizations to gain some kind of ideological foothold in that way and the kind of resources they need to even exist as organizations. But, you know, still that's at the margins. And I think really at the end of the day, the most that, you know, as a Westerner, you know, if I was involved in policymaking circles, and I really am not, and you know, my advice would not be taken seriously. My advice is essentially stop your security assistance to most countries. You know, if you're going to focus on humanitarian assistance, focus on improving trade access, you know, for African producers to European and Western markets. You know, focus on, you know, providing, you know, good offices for, you know, and boosting, you know, local conflict resolution efforts and that sort of thing. But you know, at the end of the day, what you can actually contribute is, in a positive sense, to ending, you know, to transforming regimes like that in Chad and into something like a, you know, a functioning democracy. There's nothing outsiders can really do except to make things worse. And the French have made things demonstrably worse. The U.S. has made things worse to a lesser degree because the U.S. is far less present there and is far less interested. But you know, the U.S. is just not interested in you know, really criticizing the regime. When Yeladillo was killed, Yeladillo was the main remaining opposition figure who was killed in very kind of, well, it's become clear now that he was shot in front of his, either inside or in front of his campaign headquarters, but there was a buildup to that. And the actual circumstances around the buildup to that remain pretty obscure, but it happened on February 28th. The French said nothing. The US, as far as I know, said nothing about it. So Chad's international partners have said nothing when, you know, the Chadian government assassinated the main opposition figure and the leading opposition candidate to the upcoming presidential election. I mean, to me, that's outrageous. I mean, not to say this guy was a saint, but, you know, because he does have, you know, he has a sketchy background himself. But, you know, there's no interest in promoting good governance or democracy. But even if there was, I'm really pessimistic about what could actually be done. But one thing you can do is to stop supporting autocratic regimes. And therefore, if you ask why would this arise in anti-French sentiment, it's because the French have consistently backed governments that are widely seen as illegitimate and predatory. And, you know, in the name of stability and strategic, you know, strategic interest or whatnot. But yeah, that's going to generate anger, especially if that doesn't bring results like they promise. You know, the jihadist groups spread all over the region despite the French presence, and they're backing illegitimate regimes whose practices are driving that, you know, driving the jihadist recruitment and expansion. So, like that's going to undermine.
Ironically, why the West have been conspicuously absent in criticizing the Chadian government for killing the opposition party. I want to look at the more regional implication or regionalist. I think in Sudan, I think that the assassination of the opposition party generated some sort of diplomatic rule or tension between the Sudanese government in terms of, I don't know if whether it's the opposition or whether it's Deby's government seems to have some relationship with the RSF.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so just the first part of your question, then I'll get to that, the RSF issue. So one, like the lack of Western condemnation for what's happened in Chad, and the limited condemnation for what happened earlier in Chad, the repression of these protests, is linked to, from the French side, its strategic interests. That's the last remaining foothold in the region. They don't want to lose it. And Chad has always had a particular place in Chadian and French strategic thought when it comes to Central Africa. Economic interests aren't a major role when it comes to Chad itself, because the French don't have a lot of investments there, neither does the United States. But some of the oil companies are American. But, you know, in terms of overall contribution to the U.S. economy is pretty, you know, it's a rounding error. So, you know, but it's, for them, it's about, you know, here's a country that you don't have jihadists there, and they're fighting jihadists, and they're, you know, they're a good security partner from a very kinetic perspective. That is a, you know, very, like, they kill terrorists, and you know, we like that. And also they provide a platform for intelligence gathering, for troop basing, that sort of thing, and that makes them a useful ally. So, but criticizing them threatens all that, and especially in a situation in which you have, you know, in which increasingly U.S. policymakers and French policymakers see much of Africa through the context of geopolitical competition with Russia. So going back to the Cold War, this is emerging again, and, you know, so there's no thought about the domestic or local circumstances of any African state. It's about what are the Russians doing? And then, of course, it leads to, like, terribly blind analysis, you know, like, you get the Russians are behind everything that's happening. They're behind every bush and tree. When in fact, you know, their actual influence in events is actually quite limited. But, you know, there's this, it really is a tendency to really exaggerate it. But then, yeah, so that I think that explains the lack of interest in really being vocal about this transition, which is anything but. And, you know, it's just a reaffirmation of Chad's long history of autocracy. Now, in the RSF dimension, that's where we can go back to the question of regime fragility in Chad. So there's been a narrative that's emerged among observers of the Chadian government, among opposition, you know, media, that sort of thing, that the that Mohamed Deby is the president is increasingly in a fragile situation, because one of the main political constituencies of the regime is the Zagawa ethnic group, or actually one kind of subset of the Zagawa ethnic group, and not the ethnic group itself, but rather some of their political leaders. And that's a group that lives sort of in northeastern Chad and also across the border into Sudan. And they're only about 5% of the Chadian population, but they dominated, their political leadership dominated Idris Deby's government, and also dominate part of Mohamed Deby's government. Mohamed Deby's not, I mean, from his mother's side, he's actually Guran, which is a group that's based in northern Chad. There have been some changes in the composition of what you might call the basis of the regime, but there's a lot of talk that the Zagawa themselves are very divided over Mohamed Deby's presidency, and this goes back to his father, who also was not unanimously popular among the Zagawa political leadership, and actually a lot of the main rebel leaders themselves are Zagawa, and they've been brought back into the fold under Mohamed Deby, but there's fears now that that his support for the RSF in Sudan, which is based on a number of calculations. So one is that there's fears that if the RSF loses in Sudan, that there's going to be a reflux of fighters from Sudan back into Chad, which would be very disruptive and potentially destabilizing in Chad. Also, Khemeti, the leader of the RSF, has Chadian families. He's part Chadian in a way, so that he could have political ambitions in Chad. So if he loses out in Sudan, he might try to go do the same thing in Chad. So the idea is you back him in Sudan to keep them going in Sudan so that they don't cause a problem in Chad. Also, he's getting a lot of money from the United Arab Emirates and in exchange for allowing UAE support to this has been pretty well documented by the UN in order to allow UAE or Emirati weapons flows into Sudan to the RSF through Chad to allow that and to facilitate that. In exchange, he's gotten money, he's gotten weapons. Now, among the Chadi and Zagawa, this is really controversial because El Fasher, which is one of the main city in North Darfur, is a potential battleground between the RSF and the Zagawa and Zagawa militias. And the RSF, as we know, has been committing essentially genocidal acts against non-Arab ethnic minorities, right? And this generated massive refugee flows into Chad, which is themselves destabilizing impact. Massively strain Chad's limited welfare infrastructure, and they're not getting nearly the kind of humanitarian aid that they need because of the massive distortion of the world humanitarian funding that's happened in the past couple of years. But the fear is both within the regime and elsewhere is that if Deby keeps on supporting the RSF and the RSF launches an attack against El Fasher and starts killing Zagawa, then that's going to provoke a massive reaction among Zagawa within Chad, especially within the regime itself, within the regime leadership itself, which is very divided over the RSF issue. Now, so that's the dominant narrative that's emerged. There is another aspect to it, which is that Mohamed Deby wasn't that popular to begin with. He was very contested to begin with when it came to him taking power in 2021. Within the Zagawa, and that didn't have anything to do with Sudan. It had to do with their sense that he was too young, or he wasn't qualified, he wasn't experienced enough, that they preferred somebody else within the family, it's a very extended family, also the Zagawa aren't the only aren't the only components of the regime either. So there's a question about whether the Sudan situation can bleed over into Chad in the sense of fragilizing the regime and leading to a coup d'etat, because the main security, the most powerful security force, the Presidential Guard, is a large part of it is Zagawa. It's also partly Arab and Goran and some other ethnic groups. But there's a feeling that this could lead to defections or maybe fighters going over into Sudan, Presidential Guard units leaving and going over to Sudan or launching their own rebellion. The other fear is that the recent death of Yahya Dillo, who's, as I mentioned, the main opposition leader who had not yet been co-opted, he was Zagawa. He's actually related to Mohamed Deby. He's a cousin, cousin. And he had been an armed group leader in the 2000s, one of these Zagawa armed groups that I was talking about that had opposed Mohamed Deby's father. And Yahya Dillo's, one of his brothers, Mohamed Dillo, is an armed group leader in El Fasher in Darfur. His brother has been very vocal about calling on Chadi and Zagawa to go join him to help resist the RSF. So the death of Dillo is also part of this kind of infighting within the ruling dynasty and their kind of broader sort of ethnic constituency. And the questions this raises is, does this change the balance of power within the regime? Does this affect regime fragility at all? Does this actually help consolidate Mohamed Deby's power, or does it weaken him? And I don't have answers to any of those questions.
You've touched on, I think I don't know if you've given more. I was going to talk about it seems that Chadian politics, it has this deeply, I know in Africa, in independent African states, there's a plural ethnicity. But it seems to be very specific and dynamic in the Chadian case. You've just touched upon, it seems very complex. What role does ethnicity, tribe, and all these clan alliances, what role does it play in Chadian politics? I don't know if you could add more to what you've just said.
Yeah, so So you always have to be careful because, you know, there's this tendency, especially among Westerners, to overemphasize the ethnic dimension, right? And to make that a core element of their political analyses. And I think it's, in this very specific case, I think it probably is kind of important. But chatting in politics is not just about ethnicity, right? It's also about access to, you know, it's about access to power, patronage networks, about regional exclusion. The South, for instance, is largely excluded from power. So a lot of the opposition, civilian opposition, comes from the South. And that's not necessarily organized around along an ethnic basis, or not the same way that, say, certain armed groups, northern armed groups are. And, you know, there's a lot of also cross-ethnic interests and a lot of intermarriage and that sort of thing among key political power brokers. I mean, Deby himself is, so I don't actually know the composition of his marriages, but he's and he and his father are both notorious for marrying different prominent families across the country, not necessarily along ethnic lines, but across ethnic lines and prominent families locally. The most really controversial figure was a woman named Hinda Deby, who was Idris Deby's his most prominent wife, she was part of an Arab clan in Eastern Chad called the Asil clan, and they were they played a powerful role in helping to undermine parts of the rebellion that Idris Deby was facing in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. So this kind of family and marriage politics is also really important in Chad, particularly. Mm-hmm. And with countries, you know, not, I mean, it's. Yeah, I guess the best way to think about it is it's a big conglomeration of lots of different communities that have been, you know, federated together. You know, it's almost like an empire in a way. And the imperial center is Jamuna, and Jamuna has to manage it the way that any empire has to manage it, in the sense of trying to, in the one sense, they play groups off each other. They play different local elites off against each other to maintain power. They intermarry with other elites to maintain, you know, to boost their political ties, and you know, and this, you know, and then some people raise the flag of rebellion, not because they want to overthrow the government, because this is a way of negotiating, you know, and therefore, you know, you're a rebel for a couple of years, then you reach an agreement with the government, you get some money, you get a government position, you know, you get some of your family members into, you know, a ministry somewhere, some of your followers get integrated into the army, and they have salaries and ranks, you know. And this is common. I mean, this isn't just Chadian phenomenon, right? I mean, this happens in other places as well. I mean, Congo's notorious for this. But it's really part of the.
Speaking of Congo, and I was going to tie that into elite state capture. I think all I'm saying is that about elite state capture, where the elites use conflict to negotiate power and access. And would that describe what Sosei Masra, the relationship with Sosei Masra, the prime minister, has done? And again, I wanted to comment on DRC president facilitator mediating that agreement between. What is the stake for DRC in this conflict?
For Tshisekedi, that's a good question. So part of it. Part of it links, I mean, he wants, I mean, Tshisekedi wants to play a role as a regional mediator. He wants to boost his regional, profile in the context of, you know, serious challenges to his domestic legitimacy. I mean, that's probably one element of it. You know, there's, you know, people like, I mean, I don't know if he can, he probably can't reach the level of somebody like, you know, Gabon's Omar Bongo back in the day, who would have this continent-wide status as a mediator. He'd go and try to mediate conflicts everywhere to boost his own profile. And, you know, he probably got some kickbacks in exchange for that. So I don't know when it comes to Tshisekedi. I don't really know why he particularly, I mean, he was officially named the regional mediator for Chad after the repression of the October protests in 2022. So that's probably why he was kind of the lead on this. And I don't know where the initiative came from, whether this initiative came from Sukhsay Mazla, whether it came from Deby, or whether it came from somebody else. But I mean, Mazla had been in exile for over a year, and he had visited Washington, visited Paris. I think he was trying to get traction from different partners of Chad to try to maybe facilitate his return, but also provide some degree of protection, you know, in terms of the recognition of him as an important political leader. And I think he wasn't getting that. So, and since he wasn't getting that, and I think he didn't see any alternative, you know, for getting back to Chad, then some kind of agreement with the regime, you know, that probably also played a role. But
speaking about,
you know,
But speaking about that, that in itself is quite like how you went from being a main opposition voice from last year to becoming the prime minister, and then you know, also presidential contestant, you know, whilst he's in the same government as this. A lot of people see it as a sham or as a way to yeah. kind of legitimate you know, Debbie's presidential ambitious goals. So do you see it that way?
Yeah, but I think if you listen to chatting opposition sympathizers and voices, both within political parties and civil society, they see Mazra as really having discredited himself. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's exactly the criticism that they make, that he's essentially, whether or not he was sincere before, you know, he may have been, mm-hmm. you know, he's essentially sold his soul. You know, and in that, you know, and for Debbie, yeah, this is a way of showing, oh, look, I'm really, you know, I'm really opening this. I'm a government of ouverture, a government of openness mm-hmm. to the opposition. I'm listening to other people. You know, I'm even allowing him to run for president. Look, if you mm-hmm. actually look at the list, the ballot, so they released the ballot list 2-3 days ago. And of course, mm-hmm. Debbie is the top of the list. Mazra is like number 7 in the list, you know, really buried down there. So, you know, you can see like this is he's allowing Mazra to run for president under the understanding that he ain't going to win.
He's not going to win.
You know,
I agree. So, but if we look at how the extent at which, and I think that also speaks to the seasoned politics that's been played in Chad. The way you look at how they're able to co-opt oppositions, co-opt armed groups into the party, it tells about some kind of complex system that they're wrong. But if you look beyond all of that, we'll see the referendum that I've read somewhere where the government is giving the people, free water or free electricity to them.
Electricity.
Yeah, look at
like, you know, all of these. There isn't any electricity, but the extent that there is any, yes.
They're making like a statement. So if you look at all of this, and do you think, again, we can say, you know, some of this, we can clearly see that is kind of like a way to like still make an effort, you know, to show the people that, oh, we're serious. Or is it just, is there some element of genuine, are they being genuine to some extent, or is it just political gaming in all of this?
It's political gaming. I mean, I don't see any evidence of, you know, Debbie really being genuine when it comes to wanting mm-hmm. to have a democratic future for Chad. Because what that would mean, I mean, what would basically mean would be that those who are in power would lose it. And not only would they lose power and they lose all the resources associated with power, but, you know, they'd open themselves up to things like prosecution. And, you know, that's, they, you can't accept that. You can't, you know, giving up power would mean certainly political suicide, and perhaps, you know, actual threats to your liberty. So, and perhaps worse. So there's no interest. And not only, I mean, even let's say Debbie was, you know, the most genuine Democrat in the world, you know, mm-hmm. his own power is, you know, constrained a bit by his own constituency. And it's not just an ethnic constituency. We're talking about a security elite, right? That has their hands in the oil parts of the oil sector, but also they own lots of herds of cattle. They own parts of this, essentially own parts of the state machinery, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. losing that would mean losing everything.
Yeah,
but these guys have the guns, and they have the organization, and they have the connection. You know, and they're well trained, and they are. When mm-hmm. people talk about the effectiveness of the Chadian army, and it's praised, you know, it's more in the past than the present, but really praised in the Western press for its performance in Mali and against jihadist groups.
Places, yeah.
But that's not the Chadian army. That's the presidential guard. That is the DGSSEU, which is the very well equipped and well paid component of you know, the pillar of the regime. And you know, the rest of the Chadian army is underpaid, under-equipped, under-trained. It's a hodgepodge of different integrated rebel groups, you know, ethnically quoted recruits that aren't really paid or equipped particularly well. There's 600 generals, which is more than the French have, more than the Americans have. you know, this is, and you know, a lot of them are just, you know, it's you get named a general if you, you know, if you have any kind of local political significance. Yeah. And you know, maybe you get a car and a paycheck and a house or something. Debbie actually got in some trouble because he actually tried to reduce the privileges of the generals in the army. He actually tried to retire a bunch and reduce their access to free electricity and cars and things like this. So this, you know, this results in some grumbling, which I think some people feared might lead to a coup attempt. It hasn't to date. Well, there's been some rumors that there was an attempt back in January or December, but I don't know whether to credit that with any you know.
Yeah. And I'm going to answer the last question, but I think we might have to bring you back again. There's because I've seen a trend among authoritarian governments in Africa, where whether it be in Cameroon, whether it be many of these other places, you see in Niger, Mali, you see that the larger, wider portion of the army are being under resourced and stuff. Whereby I have the elite, there's an elite called we call Bridge of the Presidential Guard. I think I'm going to do a session on that. But to conclude, I was going to ask you, what do you see? How do you see all of this playing out? Why is the election going to? Why do you see all of this playing out? And just in Chad, and also implication of that to the region itself, to the Sahel region.
Right. Ooh, that's a tough question. Okay, so the election is obviously going to go to Debbie, right? There's no way he loses this. In terms of how it plays out, so there's, you know, there are a lot of coup fears because of this, you know, this internal regime dissensions over the RSF, over Debbie himself, as opposed to somebody else within the Zagawa political leadership. And that, you know, that could result in the coup. And there's also different interpretations about his political ability. So, you know, I think my view is maybe more, more that he's actually proved himself relatively capable in dividing and ruling, and bringing people on board. Whether these into his project, whether that's sustainable in the long term is another question. Whereas others have made the argument he's actually pretty incompetent and has mismanaged political relationships among key elites. I don't have an answer to what view is actually correct. But if it's the latter view, and if this coup risk increases over time, especially if there's rumors right now of an impending fighting in El Fasher, which would bring the Zagawa question to a high pitch in Chad. Mm-hmm. If that led to a coup, that would, you know, all sorts of things could happen. That could lead to anything from a smooth transition to another probably military dictatorship to a civil war. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that we have more of the same. Maybe I have a status quo bias, but I would say that's probably more likely. Debbie keeps power in one way or the other. You have this continual game of co-optations and defections and co-optations, defections. There's cycles of rebellion, but they're more or less defeated. And this could go on for quite a while. It could also end overnight. It's really hard to say. And I mean, my job is to try to predict the future, but I can only say there are different possibilities of what can happen, but I can't tell you which one is going to be. But it's either way, it's going to be bleak because the prospects for democracy and human rights and that sort of thing are really bleak. And I don't see any improvement in any of those indicators in the near future. And that's a real tragedy.
I agree. Listen, Nathaniel, I've really enjoyed that conversation. I've enjoyed a very, very deep insight. We're very grateful to have you come on today. We will publish this sometimes in a couple of weeks, and I'll notify you once this is published. And,
sounds good.
You could help share it among your network as well. But we really do appreciate it. And we would hopefully get you back on top, because that's a really good episode I want to talk about, Presidential Guard and how the wider militaries are being undermined. So
it's an interesting question. Also part of coup-proofing strategies and how...
Yeah, coup-proofing and all that, we'll definitely... All right, thank you very much. I'll let you get back to your daughter and I'll see you soon.
Will do. Thanks a lot, Mike. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. Bye. Oh. Thank you very much, viewers, for joining me today. That was Nathan Powell, our guest. We're grateful for his deep insight. And I would implore you to stay tuned for more exciting and interesting episodes. See you next week. And don't forget to subscribe to our channels and follow and like us. Bye for now.